the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to another special episode. Wednesday, Len, Canadian Bitcoiners podcast, to the Bitcoin golden age. Are we even allowed to talk about that event on public channels yet, or we got to wait another day or two, I think?
I don't know, but just it's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Absolutely right. Beautiful. Like I'm just at awe.
We should talk. Let's start before we bring in Ben, who you guys know, BTC Sessions. Very happy to have him today. Let's talk about the show sponsor, ShakePay, best place to buy and sell Bitcoin, though you should never sell your Bitcoin. Pretty cheap spreads, pretty good app. Great team that we've had the pleasure to meet over the last little while. And of course, Len, they got three things going on. They got Shaking Sats. If you use our promo code to sign up, CBP, Charlie Beta Peter, every morning you should wake up and shake two things. One of them I can't mention on air. The other is your phone, okay? And when you shake your phone, I guarantee you'll have a more rewarding response than when you shake the other thing. 1,000 sats right into your dome after 200 days, which is not bad, man. Doesn't seem like it's going to be quick, but it is quick. Trust me. Then on top of that, you got the Shake Paid thing going on right now. So if you spend off of your CAD balance, which we'll talk about in a sec, they might comp you the whole purchase in Bitcoin, which is great. And then, of course, Len, the sats back off the CAD balance, the card, you put in your Apple wallet, put in your Google wallet, tap it, and everything you buy, you get something back. 2% on the first 5,000 and then 1% after that. It's not bad. Better than your Visa. That's a guarantee. And then we got a second sponsor that we're talking about today for the first time. Who are they?
So I'm pointing to it, Ledin. So this is going to be, hopefully I do this right because this is the first time we're doing a read on this. So if you use our referral code below, if you fund your account with 75 USDC or 150,000 Satoshis for a period of 15 days or longer, you get awarded 10 USDC. So you have an opportunity to earn a stack just by putting your BTC or your USDC on the Ledin platform. Not only that, you can borrow against your BTC. So if you have a lot of it sitting in a wallet somewhere and you want to get a little bit more money into your bank account or just buy something with it, well, you have the opportunity to do so with Ledin. You could borrow against your Bitcoin, 50% loan to value. It's a 12-month term. So for either of the two interest rates for either borrowing or the savings, check out the Ledin websites because they have various rates that change time to time. And last but not least, if you're feeling lucky, B2X, double your stack. If you think the price of Bitcoin is going up, put your Bitcoin on Ledin, double it up, and then pull it out once the price goes up. And
put your money where your mouth is, eh?
Yeah. So if you're feeling lucky, there's 2% in mint fee that goes along with that. So keep that in mind. So yeah, Ledin, it's a great service. I use it. I have some Bitcoin on there. I'm earning some interest as a result. So great stuff.
Absolutely honking, man. We're glad to bring those guys on and happy to talk about that service. Okay. Finally, Len, the main event. A lot of commentary. Yeah. Bitcoin space about whether or not Ben benches more than me. I fucking doubt it, honestly, but happy to have him anyway.
Is that commentary that's happening?
It's a lot of commentary out there. It's good to see you, man. What's going on?
Pretty good. Just, you know, living the dream other than, you know, it just started getting warm again in Calgary. You know, it always sucks here for the longest. But yeah, it's nice out. I'm enjoying. I just got back from Norway, so yeah, man.
We should talk about Oslo a little bit, eh, Len? I never even thought about that. That'd be a good, because a lot of people were there. A lot of notable Bitcoiners, obviously you included, Ben. What maybe we should start with that, eh, Len? Unless you got something else you want to hit.
No, let's hit right at, because this is a hot topic. What happened in Oslo? Why were you there? Who did you see? What'd you talk about?
Yeah, man, it was awesome. So Oslo, the reason I was there, there's a thing called the Oslo Freedom Forum, and it's put on by the Human Rights Foundation. And what's the Bitcoin connection here? Obviously, Alex Gladstein. He has been a huge proponent of Bitcoin as a humanitarian tool. And so this event, it's not a Bitcoin event, right? It's and this was one of the unique aspects about it. It's a human rights event where people from around the globe, activists from around the globe, come together and bring up various problems in and around the world to do with authoritarian governments. And Alex Gladstein has been introducing Bitcoin as a potential solution to some of those problems. And so I was involved in the one that actually took place in Miami last October. I got to head up and MC a number of things on the Bitcoin track that they had going there. And then this one, it was a lot more kind of front and center on the main stage. And then there was a Bitcoin 101 that I got to lead, like a class. And then there was a whole bunch of different Bitcoin tracks going on. There was, you know, people like Jimmy Song and Jeff Booth and Matt O'Dell and God, just so many good Bitcoiners there in one place. Like I'm having trouble naming them all because I ran into so many people. You know, Natalie Brunell was there. God, who else? John Vallis. There's just a ton of awesome Bitcoiners all in one place. Lynn Alden, people on stage talking about various aspects of it. But most importantly, how can it be used to help with some of these problems, getting value into and out of a country when you have a totalitarian regime that is cutting off legacy financial rails, escaping hyperinflation. There's a lot of good topics, and it was a hell of an event. And some of the side conversations that happened off stage were some of the more interesting ones, which I'm sure will end up being topics in future events down the road.
Were there a lot of normies over there?
Yeah, that's what I want to know too. Yeah. What was the normie crowd like?
And were they receptive of this type of message that was being conveyed?
Yeah. So, I mean, the bulk of the people at the main event are normies, right? They're mm-hmm. they're regular non-Bitcoin acclimated people, and they're learning. Now, there were a lot of Bitcoiners at this one in particular, you know, a lot of Norwegian Bitcoiners that didn't have the benefit of things like the Miami conference and things that happened in North America, kind of gravitated to Oslo because they were like, oh, holy shit, there's this person and this person. I want to see them talk. So there were a chunk of Bitcoiners in there. And so in some of the classes, like the Bitcoin 101, there were a number of people that were familiar with Bitcoin, depending on what the course was. Like there's a BTC Pay, how to set up a fundraiser one put on by Rockstar Dev. And that one had a lot of Bitcoiners in it and then a few normies in it, I think because it seemed probably intimidating to the average person. But I think we also underestimate or overestimate what your average Bitcoiner knows how to do. So I think a number of Bitcoiners went to that saying, I don't know how to use BTC Pay yet. Mm-hmm. And so they went to take that in. So I guess my overall take was the event itself was very normie centric, and then it had like a good subset of Bitcoiners in it. The Bitcoin specific non-main stage talks were heavy Bitcoiners, but the normies that were in the audience were there for a reason, and they needed Bitcoin for something specific. And that's the interesting piece of it. So I think it's a gradually then suddenly kind of thing. They estimate about 5% of the activists there are involved in or using Bitcoin in some capacity. And I think that number is going to grow.
So Gladstein is, you know, obviously big human rights guy. He talks a lot about that. He does many, many shows that are not Bitcoin related on that topic. What are some of the things that he's saying to the Oslo crowd that maybe the normal Bitcoiner doesn't think about or know? You know, when we talk to people on this show, and you're the same, Ben, obviously Why Are We Bullish is one of the, you know, monster shows in the space. You guys talk a lot about the things that make us excited as like kind of first world users, first world hodlers. What are those guys saying, you know, and Alex specifically about the use cases that we're not thinking about, and where are we in sort of building those out on the network, building out those tools? How's that look? And how was the reception to that? I would guess it was strong, but I'd be curious to hear what you say.
Yeah. So there's an interesting dynamic happening here with the presentation. So you had a mix of, I'd say, veteran Bitcoiners and people brand new to Bitcoin. So it does have to be kind of presented from that bare bones, like, what is this? Why is this even useful? Why is this a topic of conversation in the first place? So a lot of the focus it is almost, it's funny because it's kind of coming full circle because, you know, early on, I remember Bitcoiners 2014, 15, 16, it was transactional in nature, was a lot of the presentation. Oh, you can transact this fast and for this cheap. And then that kind of went away because one, that was becoming not the reality because of block size pressures and bandwidth constraints. But then also because we started focusing in on what's the bigger picture of like replacing central banks and everything. Well, I mean, the transactional nature has gone full circle in that we have Lightning. And so a lot of these people, their first interaction, the one-on-one that I did, their first transaction ever on Bitcoin was Lightning. Mm-hmm. So these people are seeing the instant settlement aspect of it, of I can get this. And so there's the transactional nature and the censorship resistance nature. And so those are the kind of the main key points that are being hit on there, where I spoke to a girl who she after the war broke out, there was all this back and forth trying to get just protective equipment into Ukraine, like just helmets and like vests. That was it. And they were trying to do that. And they were trying to get the money to purchase that equipment to get it over the border of like Poland and start to move it. And they just couldn't get it there. It was going to take weeks, like a couple weeks to make it happen. And they did it on the second day of the war because they funded it with Bitcoin. So you would see instances like that. You would see instances where, again, like bank accounts are just shut down and the real problems and solutions that are being found are not in like the cross-border payments, because we know we can just do that with Bitcoin, but what's the situation on the ground? And that's very unique to each locale. So like once you get the Bitcoin there, what are you going to do with it? What kind of local markets have developed? What things can you purchase in order to get the supplies or the utility that you need out of it? So that's kind of what they're drilling home most. They're not as much talking about the hyperinflation, although they did a little bit because Fode from Senegal was there talking about his wealth being devalued by half by the French, monetary colonialism happening. So there's a lot of that. I will say, though, there's going to come a time where the Human Rights Foundation is going to have to pick a side on a certain topic, because they had two different conflicting ideas there. There is Bitcoin, permissionless, censorship resistant, all that great stuff. And then they had another track. They had a guy come up and talk about, he said, hey, we've got a list of global ETFs here. and he said, listen, we've gone through like and tried to determine which of these ETFs are benefiting bad people, like totalitarian regimes. So like if you own these, you can actually sell them and then you're no longer helping some dictator somewhere who also owns the same thing. I was like, listen, guys, you're going to have to pick a lane, because bad people will own and use Bitcoin. And my favorite quote that I heard over the weekend from Jeff Booth was, and he used this in El Salvador too, to some of the protesters there. Somebody asked him, what's the worst thing about Bitcoin? He said, the worst thing about Bitcoin is that you not only have to accept that the person you hate can use it, you have to accept and be okay with the fact that them using it makes it better and stronger for you. And they've got to parse that, man. They've got to deal with that.
I can't believe that these guys are talking about fucking ETFs at the Freedom Forum. That seems like such a weird, I mean, I get it, but yeah, with all the content, I know, but with like all the content that I saw coming out of there, I could not, if you asked me to pick, to tell you which thing was the most controversial, I wouldn't have said ETFs that are benefiting dictatorial governments. Wouldn't have been on my bingo card, buddy. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was this. And I mean, this is just one guy's talk, but like he was presenting it as a way of pulling funding from dictators. But I mean, if that's down that same line of thought, then they're going to have to not use Bitcoin ever. and then only let dictators use it because they're going to use it.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I see it with Bitcoin is the next level of adoption is going to have to be on a retail side, because a lot of us plebs, we adopted it, we have it, but there's got to be some advancement where we could actually use it for buying and selling goods and services. So, and I'm wondering, given that the way things are transpiring in the world, it's getting harder and harder to do business because prices are going up for everything, and retailers are just taking a haircut every time they do anything, especially now with Visa, MasterCard. Every time they swipe a card, 3% is gone. You know very well about Lightning. You know very well about BTC Pay. So isn't it the next step? These vendors, small, medium, large, whoever, are going to start adopting this and to make transactions cheaper and easier rather than using old ways, using Visa, using MasterCard. How much time before we're actually going to see some level of adoption? Are we at the precipice of it, or is it still?
Speak for the entire community, Ben. Speak for everyone. Yeah. And let me know what you think. Big question there.
I don't think. I mean, in Western nations, I don't think it's as much a question of cutting down on the transaction fees. Yeah, that's a degree of it. I think it's more like in developed countries, it's going to be more so merchants. Previously, again, like to harken back to the 2015 era, you know, people added Bitcoin payment as a marketing shtick because they thought they would attract a bunch of customers, which is just like kind of ass backward thinking back then, because they were like, oh, we want to seem to be bleeding edge. We don't want to hold the Bitcoin. We're going to dump it immediately and have a downward pressure on the on the market price. But they would add it thinking they would attract all these people, which, like, there were even less Bitcoin users back then than there are now. And then, like, what was their thinking? That people would take their dollars to buy Bitcoin to then go immediately sell their Bitcoin on a purchase to which the vendor would also sell the Bitcoin. Like, it just didn't make sense. I think you'll see from developed countries first will just be companies and individuals offering products and services that just want Bitcoin. And so they'll accept it, and then they'll also maybe in some instances incentivize it because they prefer it to dollars. So I think that'll be part of it. But there is the transactional side of nations where that percentage is just a huge portion of their margins, right? Like, you know, I remember hearing stories about you know, restaurants, for instance, in kind of developing nations where the accepting Visa cards and stuff like that, because of the risk and their rates, they're basically losing huge pieces of their margin versus accepting things like Lightning or, you know, plugging in with Strike or something like that. It'll be a mishmash based on where you're located, I think.
You know, I like the retail thing. And Ben, you know, I appreciate the Oslo update. I appreciate all the stuff you're doing, you know, with the sort of helping people adopt this thing as a standard for freedom and whatnot. Now I want to talk a bit about you, your channel, okay, what you've been doing. You've been very good to Len and I. You know, we came on your show when we were just wee little babies a year ago or so. And since then, we've gotten to know you a little bit. But there's going to be people who listen to this show, as I found out yesterday. You know, there's a lot of Bitcoiners who don't know some of the biggest names in the space because they just don't ever cross that path. They're maybe not big on Twitter. They're big on the technical side or big on the innovation side, or they're working for one of these Bitcoin companies. So tell people a bit about who you are. How'd you get into Bitcoin? What's the story there? I know you've told this story before, but for, you know, the benefit of people who don't know you, you know, it's a real everyone's got this orange coin story. Not everyone turns their "I never had any Bitcoin" into a full-time job. And, you know, you're one of the few. So I'd love to hear how that went.
Yeah, man. Well, first of all, thanks for the kind words. And obviously, you guys are welcome on the show anytime. I know Len's already slated in, and Joey, you'll be – we'll find a time. We're figuring it out.
The show's going to tank when I go on it again. You'll be ready.
I kind of came across Bitcoin a handful of times before actually diving into it. So I during one of the bull markets. So I obviously saw it on the way up multiple times. So that happened for me to be 2013. I saw it in double digit prices and then thought, huh, maybe I'll look at that. And then next saw it in triple digit prices. And I thought, oh shit, I missed the boat. And then I saw it in four digit prices at the end of the year near the blow off. And so it went to like $1,200 and I was like, oh man, okay, well, I figured it's either a scam or there's something there. So I started reading. I spent probably 2 or 3 months trying to get my wits about me and at least understand the basics. After that, I felt relatively comfortable to just kind of dip your toes in. And there weren't a lot of on-ramps and off-ramps, and it was a lot more complicated than it is now. But I was able to download like Bitcoin QT, which is what Bitcoin Core used to be called, and set up a wallet and then get, you know, start getting like $50 of Bitcoin here and there. I bought like the week that Mt. Gox collapsed, which for those that weren't around, was the largest Bitcoin exchange on Earth. And it basically went tits up because of poor management. But luckily, I had read enough at that point to know that the narrative on the news coverage was totally incorrect. Like, I understood this is a crappy company that mismanaged money. It's not that Bitcoin is broken. And that was the message on the news. It was like, oh, Bitcoin got hacked. And I knew that was wrong. So I just kind of stayed the course and stuck around and saw through the bullshit and just kept learning. I spent the better part of 2 years tearing my hair out, learning how to use a lot of different stuff like apps and hardware and things like that. And I'm a pretty visual learner. So I was looking for videos and there were none. It was always like, go to this forum and read this thread. And I was like, oh God, are you serious? So I just tinkered around and through trial and error, figured out a handful of things. After a couple of years, I figured I'd try my hand at making tutorial content. And the pretext of that was I spent a decade teaching little kids how to break dance. So I was already used to like breaking down concepts in terms of dance moves for school-aged children. I also performed a bunch. And so I was comfortable in front of a camera and speaking and everything. And then I had some basic video editing skills from just like, you know, travel videos and everything like that. So I started putting together tutorials once a week. I said I'd do at least one video per week starting in 2016, and I haven't stopped. So it's been, the channel is, I think it's actually the sixth birthday of the channel coming up in like a few days here.
Nice.
Yeah, which is crazy. So yeah, 6 years making content. I also started doing, you know, weekly panel shows. I do some news shows, stuff like that. But I guess kind of what I'm most known for is in-depth, step-by-step tutorials of everything Bitcoin, whether it be wallets or hardware or how to run a node or privacy and coin join or multi-sig, just all, I kind of run the gamut of whatever piques my interest and whatever I want to get my hands on. And to date, the channel has had like 6+ million views, something like that. Yeah, so I'm happy and I get to do it as my full-time job. I did work for a bunch of Bitcoin companies in between, but it turns out I hate people telling me what to do. So here we are.
Well, just a heads up that we're at 5.5 million views. So we're catching up really fast. But in terms of selling yourself to go into Bitcoin, that's one thing. I'd love to hear your stories about selling this to your family and friends too, because they must have told you that this is the wrong thing to get into, especially at that time where Bitcoin is not as prominent as it is today. They must have tried to dissuade you. I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Before you answer that question, I want to hear specifically about your wife, because my wife is not a Bitcoiner and I am like falling down this like content hole thanks to the other guy on the panel here. And I want to know how you convinced her this was a good idea, because even though this show is growing, I cannot make any headway still. I still cannot make any headway.
I've been into Bitcoin for 8 years. So like, It was probably also a gradually then suddenly with her acceptance of it. but She's always been pretty supportive in general of just like, all right, as long as you don't screw up so tremendously that we're out of a house, then that's good. I mean, it helps that, you know, we're much better off than we were before. It helps that, I think we're the two of us together. We kind of tend to look at problems, not catastrophically, but how do we solve this? And so I'll give you an instance where, you're right, literally right before Christmas, and right before, like moments after I signed papers saying we were putting our other house on the market and buying the house we're in now, I got a call saying that I got laid off. Literally, like after the ink on the paper wasn't even dry, and I got that call, and I was like, "Oh my sweet Lord!" So I spent, I had like my 20 minutes of freaking out. And then I sat down and I just started writing a list of companies that I could reach out to and work for. And I had a job within a week, and then I was set. So I think we're pretty pragmatic when it comes to problem solving. And she kind of trusts in that. She's got a good job too. She's a nurse. So we're always kind of like, we're okay. Regardless. But yeah, it was now she's like, she knows more than she thinks she knows, because I'll come in, I'll be like, look at this stupid tweet. And she'll look at it. She'll be like, that is stupid. What an idiot. Because I was like some shit coiner or something. By the way, is this a swear friendly pod?
Yeah. Go. You can swear all you fucking want. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Cool. And I was going to touch on, Len, you're asking about what my friends thought. So one of my good friends for years, who was the biggest anti-Bitcoiner that I knew for a number of years, is now the most pro-Bitcoin. Like he's the most balls deep in Bitcoin person that I know, and has benefited the most from it. When I had said that I bought the week that Gox collapsed, I had been mentioning to a few friends, including him, that I bought Bitcoin. And the day that Gox collapsed, he texted me and sent me the article. And he's like, I hope you didn't buy any of this fucking shit. So
I'm curious, because you live in Alberta, and I'm always wondering, the Bitcoin mining scene over there, it seems to be changing quickly. I think it seems they're not as bullish. The regulators are not as bullish these days on Bitcoin
mining.
Have they
ever been bullish? What do you mean they're not as bullish these days? When have they ever been? Like, Ben runs a show with bullish in the fucking title.
We'll get to that.
He's never had a regulator on there. You think they're bullish? Have they ever been bullish on mining or Bitcoin?
It's now under the eyes of them, and they're being more scrutinizing it more deeply nowadays. I'm wondering, moving forward, does it make sense that they should be doing this? Given the fact that Alberta has so much oil and gas industry over there, they're flaring gas. They should be moving hard into combusting this flared gas instead of burning and just combusting it, turning it into energy, mining Bitcoin. Like, you're in the heart of that area. Do you not? Is this something that is not resonating amongst the people over there? Is this something that they're not talking about as a potential opportunity to make money from these oil and gas companies?
The ones that are going to get it first are the people that are directly incentivized to, which is the people running the wells themselves, and that's starting to happen. Not just here, but everywhere, right? Like there's more, like Steve Barber lives like 10 minutes from me.
So he can beat you up, by the way.
Yes, he could.
Made that very clear. Yeah.
He could. Yes, he could. Absolutely. He's a large man. But you know, he's busy. He's not sitting on his thumb over here. He's a busy man. And so yeah, like the people that are actually in a position where they're like, oh shit, we're flaring all these, you know, we're flaring methane and everything. We can, and we're paying carbon taxes for that. We can capture that. We can reduce our carbon taxes and then also make money on what was previously a loss. it's just a matter of time before that proliferates even more. The regulators are less incentivized to even bother looking at that, right? They don't really, there's no direct benefit to them out the gate, right? Like, it's not like the moment they do this, they're making a bunch of money, right? In fact, in terms of the carbon taxes and everything like that, there stands to be a loss the quicker this takes place, because that tax revenue isn't going to be coming in anymore. So, yeah, I don't know. Do I think that they'll eventually get it? Probably. You know, there's definitely been some interesting conversation, not necessarily in Alberta, but just kind of globally. You get people like, I was talking to Lynn Alden when I was in Norway, and she was telling me about her going in and speaking to regulators that had been getting their info from Digiconomist, right? You know, which is just like such trash data. Mm-hmm. And so the regulators were, they started, and they said this after Lynn Alden and another group of people, basically Nick Carter and a number of others, kind of gave them a rundown over a period of time of how this stuff actually works. And then at the end of their presentation, the regulators effectively said, you know, we started this firmly in the camp of, I can't remember his name, but Digiconomist. And now I'm unsure. And so, like, just a single talk has gone from like, yes, this person is right, to maybe not. And that in various short amount of time. So I think it's just a matter of time before the data itself is irrefutable. And the proof will be in the pudding, right? Like, when you see a jurisdiction that has reduced emissions and started generating all this revenue, then what are you going to say to that? You're going to deny that this country that has brought on a bunch of Bitcoin miners on its oil and gas wells hasn't reduced their emissions when it shows they have? So, yeah, I don't know.
I like that. And, you know, one of the things, Ben, that, you know, Len obviously mentioned that you're from out west there, but you got a national, international presence on YouTube. And one of the things that we've tried to do on the show is sort of promote like the Bitcoin lifestyle, the Bitcoin mission. We talk a lot of shit on this program about, like, you know, you should spend some, use lead in some, you know, HODL some, cold storage some, all that stuff. But I think you're the maybe first or second guy. We had Maciej Sepnik on, who's the community manager for Bull. And he's, I think, also living full on Bitcoin. And you, I think, are living full on Bitcoin. So What's that like? Like, that's got to be a struggle, but obviously it's not, because you seem to be enjoying it very much. I've been listening and watching your stuff for a long time. I never really see you in a bad mood. So things can't be that bad over there living on the Bitcoin standard.
Yeah, man. Like, it's there's a an eerie sense of peace when you don't have your money in banks. especially with the fun little debacle we had in Canada here earlier in the year. I was very happy that the majority of my wealth does not exist in a bank account. The long and the short of it is, yes, I invoice in Bitcoin. There are some sources of dollars that I have where it's just kind of de facto, that's just how it works. But the majority of my income is in Bitcoin. The dollars that I get, I just leave as dollars, because I do have a bank account. So I have some stuff that has to come out of that bank account. So I minimize my fiat exposure. But more or less, like, if I didn't have a bank account, I would be able to make it work. It would be a pain in the ass for a little bit to get things set up, but that's fine. My general thesis is, obviously, I believe in Bitcoin. I believe in the long term, it will continue to accrue purchasing power. And so my thought process is, if I can earn in Bitcoin rather than earning in dollars and then converting to Bitcoin and then having to convert some back to dollars in order to pay bills. But if I'm just earning in Bitcoin as much as possible, and then I just convert what I need for my bills, one, it incentivizes me to be responsible with what I'm spending. How much do I spend every month? you know, convert it as soon as I get paid at the beginning of the month and have that covered, leave the rest in savings in Bitcoin. There's an argument to be made that if you're simply sitting in dollars and then converting however much you think you're going to be able to have as disposable income into Bitcoin, that you're short Bitcoin, because in the end, like, you're, if you've got dollars that are just going to sit there, then why are they just sitting there? I'm totally comfortable being maximally exposed to Bitcoin at all times. Again, like, I know what I make every month, I know what my bills are every month, and I'm encouraged to save more. So I just save it. This is how it goes. I use Bull Bitcoin. I use Bitrefill. I use a number of different things. Mm-hmm. I've used Ledin whenever there's some sort of a cash flow issue and I want to get dollars, but I don't want to sell Bitcoin. So yeah, there's a variety of tools at my disposal, and I've got to tell you, man, it has gotten exponentially easier to live on Bitcoin compared to, you know, my early years.
You were doing some traveling not long ago. How was the experience traveling? It was pretty cut and dry, pretty smooth. Like, what is it? I mean, because it's one thing to get, for example, Canadian dollars or US dollars off an exchange or off a Ledin type service. Much more difficult if you want a local currency. So did you have problems with that? What is that? What was that like?
Well, you can still, like, you can fund cards and you can tap cards from your phone and all that kind of stuff. So really, like, you're just using these stopgap measures in the meantime, right? You know, like, the, you guys were talking about ShakePay earlier. You can still tap. You can still get your sats back regardless of where you are. So yeah, you can fund a CAD balance and tap wherever the hell you want. So, you know, I use the tools at my disposal wherever I see fit. There's, you know, there's a degree of interfacing with fiat. But yeah, like, I earn and save in Bitcoin. So travel, not that bad. I would like to see more physical cards available. You know, I know ShakePay's probably got that on the way at some point.
Everything's on the roadmap, man. Show me the money.
Yeah, I've been assured it's on the roadmap. Yeah, you know, I've used other cards in the past, like the ones that convert from Bitcoin to different local currencies. So I used, there's a company, I think they still exist, called Wirex, and there was another one called Bitwala, and I had those cards, and I traveled Southeast Asia with those. Main issue with cards like that in travel always is there's typically a Forex conversion because the card itself is set in a specific currency. So, like, you'll have an account that is linked to a debit card or a Visa card or whatever, but within your account, you can fund it with Bitcoin, but then you have to actually convert it to the currency of the card and then use the card. So basically, you have to, like, refill the card with fiat from your Bitcoin, and there's a fee involved in that. And then if the card is not using the local currency, like if it's a Euro card and you go to tap it and you're in Southeast Asia or something, then you're going to pay the Euro to whatever conversion, and that, you get raked over the coals for that. But yeah, it's kind of all over. Although I will say the local peer-to-peer stuff is awesome. I was in, this is like 2016, I was in Laos, and I found a little hole in the wall. There's actually not even a little hole in the wall, it was an awesome cafe / bar thing in the middle of Luang Prabang. And I had just sailed up the Mekong River for 2 days on a longboat. And I find this bar, and I walk in, and you know, me and my new wife at the time, we had just gotten married. We're having a drink. She goes up to get another. She goes to the bar. She comes back. She's like, "You're never going to believe this, but there's a sign at the bar that says we accept Bitcoin." So I go up and I get talking to the guy, and turns out he's from Calgary originally.
Small world.
And he had started up this bar in Laos, and then I was talking to him about the ATMs there and what a ripoff they are. Like, default $10 fee, $10 US dollar fee for withdrawals, plus they're like insane spread. You end up losing like $30 anytime you want to withdraw. Oh, and then they had a limit of withdrawing up to $200 worth. And I needed like double that. And he's like, oh, just shoot me some Bitcoin and I'll give you the cash. And so I was able to peer to peer on the ground in Laos with a dude that happened to be from the same city that was into Bitcoin.
That was a long time ago, 2016. And you've done a lot of traveling in your life. I'd like to know which country has been the most Bitcoin friendly, in your opinion, that's not named El Salvador.
I haven't even been to El Salvador yet, actually. It's on the roadmap. It's tough because I've done a lot at different times. I was surprised how much I encountered Bitcoin in Southeast Asia when I was there in 2016. So I encountered it a number of times, handful in Vietnam, oddly enough. And if
it's a big Bitcoin place, Vietnam, it's massive.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken though, their regulations are trash there. Like at some point it was illegal and then it wasn't. And it was kind of, anyways, there was I remember in Ho Chi Minh City or Saigon, there was a couple places I saw, but there was like a crypto broker where you could, again, like on the street, go and exchange Bitcoin for the local currency. I went to all the little underground tunnels and everything there. And, I don't know who did it, but somebody had put Bitcoin stickers all over like the Rambo gun. And where else did I encounter it? I'm trying to think. I again just did God, I'm trying to remember where all I've been in the past number of years. Norway, there was, you know, local shops and everything. Also I was privy to it because of the locals there were Bitcoiners and telling me where to go. But yeah, I mean, brick and mortar stuff is harder, right? Brick and mortar stuff, you're less likely to encounter. And if somebody accepts it brick and mortar, the chances of somebody walking in the door that has Bitcoin and wants to spend it is kind of, but Miami during the conference, they've got like a whole, I don't even know what it's called, like a market that all of the vendors accept Bitcoin via Lightning, which was awesome. There's a taco joint that I've been to multiple times now that accepted Lightning. There's a good number down in Florida, I think, that are doing it too. I don't know. There's been a lot, but again, brick and mortar, it's still a patchwork, I think.
It's going to take a long time. You know, some of the stuff you do on your channel, Ben, is going to lend itself to eventual adoption by brick and mortar retailers, bars, stuff of that nature. And so I was, we don't do tutorial videos. Len, once in a while, if he gets bored or gets tired of talking to his wife, might like buy something and make a video about it. But like, we don't really do it often. You do a lot of tutorial videos and you do them for things like Lightning wallets, Nodes and whatnot. What in your view is the, I don't want to say the best wallet, because there's different features that of course each one does well and some others don't do that well, right? That's fair. But in your view, what is the, you know, what is the sort of, what is the feature that Lightning wallets need the most to encourage that adoption? Because really, you've seen probably more Lightning wallets, Lightning hardware than anyone else that we know. Yeah. And it seems to me that the incentives are obvious and the last hurdle is kind of UI, right? So what do they need? What are they missing right now?
So I really like Moon Wallet. And the reason I like that one is primarily the unified balance. So you can accept on-chain and Lightning, but it shows a singular balance. It's just all Bitcoin. And you don't need to know what's going on in the back end, right? If you go to send and you scan a QR code, it doesn't matter if it's an address or an invoice, it will see what it is and figure it out and present you on your screen with what you need to do. There's a couple things here. The main thing I think is on the receiver's end. If you're a person using, say, Moon Wallet and you want to receive, you have to designate on-chain or Lightning. I would love to see that baked into one. And so there's some technical hurdles there into how exactly that would work. But I would love to say default, I'd love to accept Lightning. But if they're sending from a non-Bitcoin or a non-Lightning wallet, then it should default to an address. And so there's ways you could do that where you could bake that into a single QR code eventually. I think the backups and how to recover channels and everything like that, that's a bit of a hurdle, because that's a bit of a gray area and there's a lot of question marks there into how exactly that should work and does work. And the other thing is the mass rollout of Lightning addresses. So having what looks effectively like an email address, but just to receive Bitcoin. So you see it in some custodial services. So a good example is the Zebedee wallet. You can have a Lightning address. So I have like btcsessions@zbd.gg, and anybody with that information can send, you know, a Lightning transaction to it. So yeah, there's a number of things there. The one thing that I'm not as much a fan of Moon Wallet is the non-traditional way of backing it up. You can back it up and associate it with an email address, which it could be a dummy email address, doesn't matter. You're in essence relying on Moon to continue existing to recover that. There is a way to recover it without, mm-hmm. but it's not user friendly. It's like here's a file and you got to go into the command line and everything in order to recover it. And it has to do with how it's working on the back end, but it's less than ideal. So there's lots of hurdles there, but I will say, holy crap, is Lightning ever easier than it was when I first played with it? Because again, to download Moon Wallet and have a single unified balance and be able to shoot back and forth in non-custodial Bitcoin is pretty huge.
And let's stay on the topic of Lightning. And somebody asked me yesterday, what type of Lightning node should I install? And the one that I install, I have Raspi Blitz. So I only have knowledge of that. I'd love to know your thoughts. What is the best Lightning node software somebody should install? Is it Umbrella? Is it something else?
What makes it the best? Is it best like functionality? Is it ease of use?
Yeah, I was going to say for a new user. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. where I was going to get at. So like new users trying to just get on board, is Umbrella really the best one out there, or is there something else you'd recommend?
So Umbrella is just stupidly user-friendly in terms of starting up, right? Like you get a program and you flash it onto an SD card and plug it in. Like it's pretty much, and like putting together the actual, if you do opt to put together your own device, it's like, do you know how to use a screwdriver? Do you know how to insert a Nintendo cartridge? You're probably good. There were some community back and forth on their licensing agreement. People were saying, well, it's not FOSS, it's not free and open source software. The licensing thing around Umbral, I don't have a problem with it. The way that they work in terms of not being fully open source, it's open source in that you can read and audit the code. Anybody can fork it and use it. You just can't make money on that software afterwards. So you could fork it, but you can't fork it and then sell it and make money off of the original creation. Should note that CoinKite does the same thing now. You can audit the code. You can see what's going on under the hood. You can fork it. You can make whatever the hell you want, but you can't make money off of it after the fact. So that's kind of done in the interest of it's a protective mechanism to prevent large companies coming in. And this is what Facebook and Google and, you know, companies like that are famous for, is they'll sweep in, they'll grab a piece of open source software. And then because they've got money, they'll pay somebody to slap a really nice coat of paint on it. And then they'll sell it. And the original creator of it gets sweet fuck all. Mm-hmm. And so that's what this licensing thing is. But yeah, in terms of the ease of use, Umbral is beautiful. My node is also really good. I have yet to use the Start9 Labs embassy, but that's on the roadmap.
Is the embassy the one that has like a home server as well baked in? There's like some other stuff they make. That's that one, right?
Yes. Yes, that's right. And they started attacking it that way first, but Umbral has since done a whole bunch of the home server stuff as well. So you can host and have passwords and all that kind of stuff. So you can kind of do it all. The way that I manage my Lightning node is through ThunderHub is the software that I like to use. I will say that managing your own Lightning node is a learning curve. It's totally different from just like downloading Moon Wallet or Breeze or whatever on your phone. It's like, you know, some thought goes into it and you kind of need to figure out what the hell you're even doing and why in order to get it working. But Umbral, yeah, I stand by my use of Umbral. It's on my shelf right there.
So before I throw it to you, Joy, I just got to make one comment. He's bang on, because understanding when and why to rebalance, you don't know why you'd have to do it until you actually dive in, and then you figuring out how to do it and try to make it as profitable as possible. It's definitely challenging at the echo, but it's easy to get a hold of. You just have to dive in. It's just not too hard.
Why don't we talk about why it's challenging, Ben? Like, do you have a video on that? You want to talk about it? Because I'm a Lightning complete noob. Like the mobile wallets I can handle, but like a node and stuff, I've never dabbled. I should at some point, obviously, but yeah, like why is it difficult? You guys would know better than me.
Well, so you're trying to manage liquidity in two directions, right? Let's say, Joey, if I want to be able to pay you or pay you and all the people you're connected to and all the people they're connected to, I need to open a channel to you. So I need to lock up some Bitcoin between the two of us. Now, by default, if I just open a channel to you, let's say I open a channel with 1 million sats. Well, when I open that channel, unless I change anything, I'll have 1 million sats on my side of the channel and 0 on yours. So that means I can pay you and all of the people you're connected to and so on and so forth up to 1 million sats, but I can't yet receive anything. So that presents a bit of an issue, because how do I start receiving payments? What if I want to receive payments? So you've got to worry about inbound liquidity as well. And if your inbound liquidity is not well connected, like somebody could open a channel to me, but they're not connected to anybody else. Well, that does me no good whatsoever, because that one person I could receive payments, but if I want to receive a payment from somebody way down the line, there's no connection there. So you've got to kind of figure out where that liquidity lies, what channels are good and actually being used and are active, and which ones to cut, you know, just close because they're not serving a purpose. So if you get a good 5 or 6 channels set up that are decent liquidity and are connected in the right ways, then you're probably fine. But it does take a bit of learning. Yes. And if you want to be like a routing node, then that's a whole other thing, because if you're just using it to receive some payments and send some payments, no big deal. But if you're like, I want people to route payments through me and maybe I'll make a few sats every time, you got to be thinking.
Yeah. And it takes a lot of time, because you're going to be rebalancing at least once a day or multiple times a day just to deal with all the changes in liquidity.
So let me ask you guys then, is the problem with the Lightning and the channel balancing, is it that people don't have the technical competence to handle it? It seems like it's a lot, right? That's one piece. Or is it that they don't have the Bitcoin that they're willing to lock in the channels? Because those to me would be two hurdles. Like, would I put a bunch of Bitcoin in there knowing that people want the liquidity and need the liquidity? I don't know. I'm not sure that I would do that. So what is the bigger hurdle in your opinion? Either of you. Len, you're a guest now too. Yeah. Who's going to take that one?
I always expected that number two is the amount of liquidity you're putting on there. And then once you have it there, you have to make the right... you have to open up the right channels with the right people to ensure that money or funds will go in and out, continuously, or else it's just going to sit there and do nothing. As Ben mentioned, if somebody opens up a channel and it just goes to nowhere, well, it's just going to sit there and do nothing. But yeah, it's putting the right amount of liquidity out there, opening the right amount of channels, the right size, and ensuring that you're continually balancing it. once you have enough liquidity out there and it's you open up the right channels to the right people, it takes care of it for itself as long as you're willing to rebalance it periodically.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I think a lot of people just get intimidated learning new things. And this isn't like a, oh, I just didn't want to take the time to download the app and learn a few buttons. It's like a, you've got to learn where to find the nodes that you want to connect to and things like that. So there's definitely just some thought that goes into it in terms of the liquidity as well. That's probably also a factor. Cause like, why do you want to open up a bunch mm-hmm. of channels? If you don't have a purpose. It. Yeah. If you don't have a purpose to be sending and receiving payments, then why would you? Eventually there may be incentive. And there's starting to be incentive to earn yield on your Bitcoin in a risk-free way, or because you can lock up capital in a channel where you're not giving up custody when somebody's requesting liquidity, requesting inbound liquidity. So if you had a node and you're like, I'm a business and I want to accept Lightning payments and I need a buttload of inbound liquidity, I would like to all pay you X number of basis points to open up a channel with me and keep your capital locked up for the next month, then sure, that could be attractive because the risk there is minimal. And after that time, I can close the channel if I see fit. All I need to do is just have that Bitcoin sitting there in that channel. And then you can receive payments. So there is opportunity there. And as that market kind of figures itself out, then maybe more people will jump on board for that reason.
Now, I want to be respectful of your time. So I have one last question I want to ask mm-hmm. before passing it off to Joey. Why are you bullish on Bitcoin?
There's so many reasons. look back at my catalog of tutorials, and literally every tutorial I do makes me more bullish because there's so many amazing tools being built. And I just have, when I started the channel, people thought, well, aren't you going to run out of things to cover? Just It's been a long time. It's been 6 years, and I'm my list of stuff to cover is growing faster than the time I have to cover it. So
that's a great answer. It's so true. People are like, oh, aren't you going to get tired of talking about Bitcoin? Like, obviously, you don't know anything about Bitcoin. If you think we're going to get tired of talking about it, it's an addiction. It's an addiction. Okay, Ben, you've been great. Of course, we knew you were going to be good. You're doing your own thing. You're good in front of a camera. We don't have to draw blood from a stone here, but we got to ask you the one last question that we ask everyone. Okay. We're going to keep it Canadian here for the sake of the show, for the sake of our Canadian, conciliaries in the audience. If you and other Canadian podcaster, John Vallis, are in a parking lot and 40 yards away is the finish line, you guys are wearing your best pair of running shoes, shorts, whatever, who's winning in that 40 yard dash, you or John?
John is going to destroy me. Not only would he beat me like bench pressing, but I'm more confident in my weightlifting ability than my sprinting ability. I've got, those years of breakdancing have not been kind to my knees. I'd get a stride or two and then I'd be on the sidelines.
Johnny, he's taking it home. We'll have to get him on, Len. We got to see if he's as generous in his interpretation of the race as Ben was.
Let's hear if he's going to concur with that result too. Who knows?
Yeah, no shit. Ben, tell people where they can find it, even though they already know. We got to do it. The handoff. Maybe you have an Instagram page where you, you're breeding rabbits or something you want to share. I'm not sure. You can share whatever you want.
You can find me YouTube, obviously, BTC Sessions. You can find me on Twitter, where I'm most active, again, at BTC Sessions. And as a matter of fact, I do have an Instagram page, which is literally just whenever I get something cool, I'll take a picture of it. And so it's just like a bunch of gadgets sitting on my dusty desk. So it's the same handle. I will do one throw, though. I'm going to be in Vancouver on July 16th running a workshop. Two workshops. One is for newbies. It's a morning workshop on self-custody. But then the afternoon workshop is a deep dive on the cold card and everything about how to set it up, how to back it up properly, how to do partially signed, like our air gaps transactions, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, July 16th in Vancouver, and you can find tickets on my website, btcsessions.ca.
Also, you're doing one in New York City, if I'm not mistaken.
I am. I'm figuring out a venue. But yeah, I'm going to be in New York. I think it'll end up being Saturday, August 13th is when that one's going to run. And I think I'm going to go, rather than doing a beginner session, I think I'm going to do a deep dive on Sparrow Wallet in the morning and then a deep dive on Cold Card in the afternoon.
Why don't you just use MSG? MSG is not available for you?
You could sell it out.
6 million views. Yeah. Tell them 6 million. What do you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
No problem. Just
all I need is 1% or 10, or sorry. Yeah. 1% of all the people that watch my show. And
that's good. That's good. Ben, BTC Sessions, you've been great, man. Check his stuff out. You guys already all watch it. We all watch Ben's stuff. He's a monolith. So thanks for your time, buddy. We appreciate it. Everyone else, take care. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Way to go. Good job.